All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you all. Please be seated. Good morning. I'm pleased to be in Lewiston this morning, meeting with the Idaho Supreme Court for one case to be heard. So we welcome all of you who are here and appreciate the accommodations and welcoming of the Lewiston folks on our behalf. The case before us today is Martin versus Board of Regents. Oh, I'm sorry, I have the wrong notes up. Sorry about that. White versus Idaho Transportation Department. There we go. Case number 50746. In this matter, the appellant is Aaron White, represented by Joseph Sullivan. The Idaho Transportation Department is respondent, represented by Mark Jackson. In this matter, we would note that Justice Colleen Zahn has recused herself, and so we have, and I'm pleased to have Judge John Judge sitting in pro tem capacity with us for this hearing. With that, counsel, are there any preliminary matters for this court before your argument today?
There are,
Your Honor.
Very well. Then, Mr. Sullivan, you may proceed.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Joseph Sullivan, I'm counsel for the appellant, Mr. White. On August 26, 2022, Mr. White had to make a decision that was really no decision at all. His wife and he were camping. They were out Two Mile Road, which is a rural area in Shoshone County. The place that didn't have cell service, they were had been operating their ATVs, and Mrs. White crashed hers. She sustained a pretty significant head injury. She was bleeding significantly from the head, and they had no cell service. There were no other people around where they were camping, and so Mr. White did what probably any husband would do. He put his wife in their vehicle and started driving immediately down to get medical assistance. Ultimately, they ended up at Shoshone Medical Center, where they were contacted by law enforcement. He had been able to make a 911 call on his way down to the hospital to try to get assistance from medical and law enforcement services. The ambulance wasn't close enough or readily deployable in a manner in which that it could get to her faster than he could get her to the hospital, and so he continued on and drove her to the emergency department. Ultimately, he was contacted by law enforcement there. He was investigated for driving under the influence, had a breath test that was in excess of 0.08, and the law enforcement issued the notice of suspension, which began the administrative license proceeding that started this case. At that hearing, we made an evidentiary presentation that identified the background for the case in conjunction with the documentation, probable cause affidavit that was submitted by law enforcement. Mrs. White testified about her medical condition. Mr. White testified about his inability to do anything other than drive her to the hospital. And counsel, I made argument that pursuant to the defense of necessity, that all of the elements had been met factually, and made a request to vacate the suspension on those grounds. The hearing officer ultimately sustained the suspension and relied on the decision in Henry v. State of Idaho, which had previously identified that the defense of necessity is not available to argue in the administrative hearing. Your Honors, the principle of necessity is deeply rooted in Western civilization. In the book of Matthew, Jesus defended his disciples plucking and eating of corn on the Sabbath day by reminding the Pharisees of David, who, when hungered, had entered the house of God and eaten the showbread, which was an awful thing to eat reserved only for the priesthood. In English common law, courts have stated the principle of necessity as a defense as far back as the 16th century. And it's recognized in Idaho today by virtue of Idaho Code Title 73, Section 116. The reason for this appeal is because the hearing officer in the underlying administrative suspension relied on Henry v. State of Idaho to deny consideration of the affirmative defense of necessity in this matter. In Henry, that court made two essential findings. The common law defense of necessity didn't apply an administrative license proceeding because it wasn't identified as one of the five statutory grounds to vacate a suspension under Idaho Code 18802A7. And two, even if it did, in that case at least, the petitioner had failed to provide a sufficient evidentiary showing to demonstrate that his driving was necessary in that case. On appeal, we're asking this court to overturn the district court decision and supporting the officer's reliance on Henry v. State of Idaho to deny the petitioner the defense of necessity in the underlying administrative proceeding.
Was there an underlying following this criminal proceeding in which the defense of necessity would allow to be asserted?
It was asserted, Judge. That was asserted to the prosecution. In lieu of that being actually heard in court, there was a resolution that involved admitting what was, in his case, a second offense DUI charge to a non-18804 offense, and it was resolved as a compromise.
So
that satisfaction.
Your client was afforded then the defense of necessity as to the criminal charge?
Yes, Judge. He was, and we did so in that case. In Reagan, this court held that State v. Clark, and by implication the exclusionary rule, would apply to administrative license proceedings. There, this court ruled that the breath test evidence that had been gathered in connection with an unlawful arrest couldn't be used to affirm the corresponding administrative license suspension because the evidence obtained in that case was pursuant to an illegal arrest. It had violated the petitioner's Fourth Amendment constitutional rights, and the department's decision affirming that suspension violated Idaho Code Section 67-5279, subsection 3A, because its legal conclusions were inconsistent with the protections afforded under the United States and Idaho constitutions. Accordingly, at least in part, the exclusionary rule identified in State v. Clark is now an accepted defense that can be argued to vacate an administrative license proceeding and suspension in those proceedings. Further, Reagan clearly identified that Idaho Code Section 67-5279, subsections 3A, holds agencies to the same constitutional standards as our trial courts, and that a district court is correct to vacate a license suspension when constitutional standards are violated.
So, Mr. Sung, let me jump in here and ask you a question. When we're looking at most, if not all, of the five exceptions, but the five reasons that an administrative license suspension may not hold in the statute, and include the Reagan case in that, we're talking about things that go to either the illegality of evidence that is obtained or something that's wrong with the testing itself. And so we're at the front end of things. You're talking about an affirmative defense that essentially comes after or upon an admission, essentially of guilt to at least the criminal charge. How do you square that? We're at opposite ends of considering where information can come in and draw.
Well, Judge, I guess I would make a little clarification that the two procedures are independent from each other. So the administrative procedure usually is initiated at the same time that a person's charged in a criminal case, but when the Transportation Department has that administrative proceeding, they're required to hold a hearing within 10 days. There's grounds that for good cause they can extend that hearing by an additional 10 days. But almost always, the administrative proceeding, at least at the hearing officer level, is resolved before the case ever sees its first court hearing. And so the administrative procedure is not predicated on a conviction of guilt or a finding of guilt in the criminal court. It's an independent analysis that the hearing officer, within the structures of the statute and the Administrative Procedures Act, that sets forth for that procedure to make that determination.
I understand that part, and I probably didn't word my question very well. What I'm really trying to focus on here is what we're looking at in terms of the things that would come in or that would prevent that suspension in the civil administrative proceeding. We're talking about considerations up front. The arrest was illegal. The testing machines were not working well. Things along that line. Whereas when you're talking about the necessity defense, you're talking about something that assumes that everything else was fine and that the person is actually guilty or did commit driving under the influence, but it takes it away from the back end. That's what I'm talking about. How do you square that?
Well, Judge, I think the idea of having the administrative and the criminal cases work in companion within the statutory scheme is still predicated on an offense, a violation of the law, but by virtue of a necessity defense or any affirmative defense, that's conduct that is legally excusable. By common law, it's described as it's a person who's breaking the words of the law without breaking the law. And if that's not something that can be asserted in a due process manner on the administrative side, we are in fact denying somebody the privilege of driving for something that is lawfully excusable. That's the basis, that's the real root of the appeal here, is that the courts are going to hold the department to the same constitutional standard as the courts, then having a mechanism or an avenue in the administrative procedure to assert that the conduct itself is in fact not lawful should be a basis of that due process, right?
You mentioned due process. Are you claiming that this is a due process violation not to consider the necessity defense?
I would argue that, at least from a procedural standpoint, the fact that it's not an avenue for something to be able to assert that the conduct itself, the underlying conduct that's the basis of the suspension was in fact lawful conduct, is a violation of due process rights.
And you said procedural due process.
Procedural due process, yes.
Yeah, your client had procedure. He was able to be heard.
Yes, Judge.
Okay. Is there anything you'd like to expand on in that sense then?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So is it your position that in all common law defenses rise to the level of constitutional rights?
I would not make that assertion, Judge, but I think the fact that at least with the affirmative defenses that are specifically outlined, especially the ones that have been identified previously by Idaho courts and being a part of Idaho law, we have standard jury instructions for those affirmative defenses. They're easily understood and applied. I would assert that as a whole, the court should consider including those as part of the hearing officer's ability to consider in determining whether or not the suspension is sustained, specifically necessity in this case, but I think the argument applies to all of them.
So if this court had recognized a common law defense, then it's your position that it's also constitutional, it rises to that level?
I think that the constitutional aspect rises in the ability of the Sixth Amendment for a person to assert a defense. Specifically with the fact of an affirmative defense, it's an ability to make sure that the conduct was in fact not lawful. Honorable Judge Meyer is certainly correct that that's not something that you make on the front end, but as far as that being something that the department is limited to not being able to consider by virtue of the statute identifying five other things, I don't think that that's a sufficient basis to deny somebody the ability to make that assertion. The department frequently vacates administrative suspensions for grounds not identified in the statute. They vacate administrative suspensions on procedural grounds routinely. If an officer doesn't turn his probable cause affidavit in within the time frame identified in the IDAPA statute, they vacate the suspension constantly. If the hearing officer's clerks don't schedule a hearing on a request within 20 days of the request for some reason or another, they'll vacate that suspension. If an agency is subpoenaed for audio, video, or logs for a breath test and the agency fails to comply with the subpoena, the agency will vacate that subpoena or the suspension. Similar, if you subpoena an officer to a hearing and he fails to show up, the hearing officer will vacate that suspension. Those are all identified by the department as violations of procedural due process in those proceedings.
I almost completely agree with you. I think that was a good answer, but I guess my concern is just because a defense is recognized as part of a regulatory scheme, or even by this court in a typical criminal proceeding, does that mean it automatically ascends to the constellation of constitutional rights?
No, I wouldn't agree with that. I think that's something is specifically identified and understood as necessity would rise to that level. But I would have not made that analysis on every affirmative defense independently. I wouldn't trust that.
Historically, dating back to the common law, if you want even back to Matthew, the necessity defense is a way of overcoming the intent element, correct?
Not being a common law scholar, Judge, I think that that's, I don't think it's simply a negation of an element. It is, if proven, or if the burden is shifted in criminal context to the state, if the state's not able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the affirmative defense does not apply, it excuses the conduct. It makes conduct that's otherwise illegal legal in those circumstances.
Right. So it's not unlawful to do good on the Sabbath, quoting Matthew again. But what I'm getting at is, if we're dealing with something that's maybe not even an offense, it's a regulatory proceeding involving the privilege of holding a driver's license, I'm just wondering why intent and negating intent would have any relevancy to that proceeding. I'm just not aware of any administrative license revocation proceeding in which the issue of intent is considered.
I think it's more about the culpability of the conduct as opposed to whether the intent element is specifically met or not met.
Culpability is separated from intent. I'm not sure I understand.
Well, just the consequence of the action. The suspension of the revocation of a privilege, the imposition of a civil offense, the requirement to have an interlock device. Procedurally, if somebody's conduct, the underlying conduct itself, can be established as being lawful, I don't think that it rises to a due process protection to have somebody not have any ability to make that assertion, to defend themselves from those consequences. I think a lot of the questions have covered a lot of the things I was going to continue with, so I'll just conclude briefly. Thank you. Accordingly, petitioner is respectfully requesting and asking this court to overturn the ruling of the district court and remand this back to the hearing officer for reconsideration as to whether or not the petitioner had made sufficient evidentiary showing to satisfy the elements of the defense of necessity, and if so, by overturning the district court decision and allowing the hearing officer to vacate the administrative suspension if the factual basis had in fact been established sufficient to do so. Thank you.
Before you sit down, I just have one question. We're taking away any of your time, though. How is Mrs. White?
She's recovered fully. Thank you.
And I have a question about your client himself. His suspension has been fully completed, has it not?
It has, Judge. In the length of time it took for the district court to issue an order staying that suspension at the district court level for the original petition for judicial review, there's only been a little bit of time remaining. And so it has passed in full.
Are there any other aspects of the suspension of the civil proceeding, or the civil proceeding, that administrative license suspension that he is still subject to?
I would have to recalculate it, Judge, but I'm pretty sure that even the one-year I believe he'd still be under the administrative requirement for the interlock device because of the original stay until the district court's opinion. I would have to map that, Judge, but I believe that he's either at the end of that or near the end of it, but somewhere very close to that time frame. Certainly was still under subject to that at the time that the appeal was filed.
So the suspension, after the stay was lifted, the suspension went to sometime in May of 2023. And so does the ignition interlock go for a year after that?
And procedurally, Judge, in this case, when the stay order was put in place, he, I believe, gone through approximately 60-some days of the original 90-day suspension. It was stayed during the pendency of the district court appeal and petition for judicial review. When that decision was rendered, it restarted the remainder of the suspension, and then the one-year clock would have gone from there. So I think potentially he's still past that. That does not make this issue moot, though. Should the suspension be vacated, the record of the court suspension, the administrative suspension and the requirement for the interlock would be removed from his driving record, and certainly that's something that would have an applicable benefit to him in seeking employment for insurance rates for SR-22 purposes. There's still benefits to him in being successful in this appeal that are tangible.
I appreciate that clarification. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Appears there are no other questions at this moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Johnson, sir.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices, Judge of Justice, Madam Clerk. My name is Mark Jackson. I'm honored to be here in this great old building that I spent 40 years ago. I was a public defender here in this nice building and spent a lot of time there during law school. The broad issue in this case is, given the Reagan case, can a necessity defense be used in an ALS proceeding? A couple of fill-in facts as to what occurred. Mr. White went down to the bottom of the hill and met the police officer that had been called by his wife or the ambulance company. And the officer comes up and says, what's going on? Brief explanation, the officer says, I will follow you. They follow him to the hospital and get out of the car. They take his wife out. The officers are watching him. He reparks his car, walks into the hospital, and they notice he had the slurred speech and he had visions of drinking six beers, and then he admitted he was probably over the limit, and that created the probable cause, which happened very quickly as opposed to a situation where they stop a car and go through the normal procedures. Mr. White's main arguments is that the necessity defense somehow violates the Constitution in this case, constitutional standards. And our position is that it does not approach constitutional standards. The evidence, part of his argument is the evidence was obtained unlawfully or illegally. There was no illegal obtaining of evidence in this case. It was a simple stop. The man had just gotten out of his car, alcohol. We don't have all the complexities of the Reagan stop, of step-by-step what happened during the process. And there was a hint of a suppression analysis in Mr. White's briefing. This isn't a suppression issue. So, briefly, I want to address some issues about my briefing stands, but some main issues about the case, and then I'll address the two main statutes that apply. The Reagan case did not involve necessity, so there was no necessity issue connection with the Reagan case. There's no facts here of any illegal stop. There's nothing there. Reagan was based on, you got an illegal stop, you can't have a test. It's going to be illegal to have a test after an illegal stop. You do not have that situation of Reagan. We don't have a citizen's tip. This isn't a citizen's tip case or a case where the arrest was outside of the presence of the officer. This is not that case. There is necessity is an affirmative defense, and it's not a constitutional right. It's an affirmative defense. There's lots of affirmative defenses in the law, in the criminal law, duress, self-defense, insanity, statute of limitations, entrapment. In a DUI setting, maybe involuntary intoxication. I've heard of some of those cases. Somebody else fed on the alcohol. But those are affirmative defenses in a criminal case. They're not defenses in our narrow statutory scheme for the ALS proceedings. Necessity is not constitutionally based. There's nothing in the Constitution about affirmative defenses. It's not in our statutes. I understand some statutes, state statutes, have necessity as an affirmative defense in a criminal case. We don't have that. Again, there's no illegal arrest. The policeman was just doing his job, so there's nothing about the arrest, or there's nothing about an unconstitutional statute applying to the arrest. There's no, I'll just say it again, this is not the Reagan case, of a pretty complex case in the sense of they had to go step by step through an analysis of the officer originally seeing it. I had to read it a few times because it's step by step of what he did, and at some point in time it became illegal, and he didn't have probable cause to ask her to take the test, and we just don't have that here. We do not have that complex Reagan analysis. There's no case law that supports the position that says necessity is part of an ALS proceeding. No cases have been provided, as one of the district judge pointed out. More simply, there's no officer wrongdoing here. The officers did absolutely nothing wrong, despite assertions by Mr. White that it was some sort of unlawful issue. When you have a necessity defense, you don't bring a motion to suppress. You bring a motion to dismiss, I guess. Or you just try it at trial and have the defense hovering with the jury instructions. I guess you could bring a motion to dismiss ahead of time, but it's not a motion to suppress. An officer in a criminal or an ITD kind of process should not be in the position of deciding out in the field whether the gentleman has met his burden by a preponderance of the evidence that he has a necessity defense. That's not an officer's job. He doesn't get out his law book and read the four elements of a necessity, and if he did, there'd be a problem with Mr. White here, because once he met the officer going down the hill, he could have said, I guess, I've been drinking, I need another drive. So part of the necessity defense is there was no other way. I mean, necessity is essentially, I committed a crime and have no other option. He had a great option here. When you read some of these old necessity DUI cases, you know, most of them are, I had to drive my wife to the hospital, an emergency occurred. I get that. But this one, there was a flaw in front of that, the necessity defense. He had the officer right there. He could have said, you know, I need help. Would you drive? Or something like that. So this isn't even the simple necessity. This isn't the simple case of driving your wife to the hospital after a tree falls on her and saying, I had to do it. But regardless, an officer's, that's not his job to decide that in the field. So the idea that this is some sort of unlawful arrest, the cloud is that he should have done something, that's not his job to decide that. Lastly, now that I've introduced those other facts, I apply 18-8002, Big A 7 and 67-5279 sub 3, which I will just loosely refer to as 8002 and 5279. They give in this narrow civil proceeding, they give the five factors each of what has to be proven by the driver. So that's a whole change of burden of the proof is on the driver. And using 8002, as I understand the argument, White must be saying there was no legal cause to stop. That doesn't fit. There was a legal cause to stop. Officer saw him get out of his car, walk up, and he smells the alcohol, slurred words, admissions of drinking going on. So under 18002, the only element could be the first one that they are challenging, and it's no legal cause to stop. It doesn't fly. In 5279, as I understand it, the argument is it violated constitutional and statutory provisions. There isn't a constitutional provision. There's no statutory provision. It's simply this affirmative defense that all persons, in a case like this, in the criminal proceeding, they have the full right in a criminal proceeding to bring this defense. But the narrow statute doesn't say that in an ALS proceeding. It just says, so there's been no showing of a constitutional statutory provision, and Judge Meyer noted that in her district court opinion. The Henry case, the judge in the Henry case, same application. He didn't have Reagan, but our position is Reagan didn't change anything with respect to a necessity defense. The ITD has asked for attorney fees in this case, and that's all I have.
How should we look at these administrative proceedings? Are they just purely civil, or are they quasi-criminal? I'm just wondering if we were going to put it in a box, what box it should be put in?
Oh, that's a good question. There, no doubt Reagan intertwined them with some constitutional issues. Given the facts of Reagan and an unconstitutional statute and an illegal arrest. But if it's one box or the other, it's a civil box with very tight ropes on what the burden of proof is that the driver has to show. So it's a narrow, select civil proceeding, administrative proceeding that There was some language in the Reagan case that had some constitutional language in it. I don't think the court intended to apply every, certainly the court didn't apply all affirmative defenses, because they're not constitutionally based.
Well, candidly speaking, looking at the first defense on these administrative proceedings is that the officer did not have legal cause to make the stop, mm-hmm. or to make the seizure, as in the case of Reagan. I've always been surprised that some people look at Reagan as this great leap forward, when in fact Reagan was just concluding that there wasn't legal cause because of the Constitution.
Yes.
And I'm just trying to understand why that is seen by some to be, a watershed moment in jurisprudence.
And I don't think it was for the present case. I mean, Reagan, I had to keep on reading Reagan because there's a lot of elements to it that go on, but basically you can't have a breath test if the original stop was illegal. I get that, but I don't know how that ties to the present case. But a completely different issue with the necessity.
Further questions?
Any other questions?
Here's none. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have in me?
12 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Judge. Certainly, the petitioner is not asking the court to make a finding of fact in this case as to whether or not the petitioner's circumstances or the facts of the case meet the elements of the defense of necessity. This is just simply whether or not the hearing officer has the authority to make that determination for himself. We're not trying to disturb anything in the requests for a remand for further consideration.
Mr. Sullivan?
Yes, Judge.
Can you get a little closer to the microphone with the fan on, and it makes it a little harder. Thank
Certainly,
you.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The better. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Certainly, affirmative defenses were on the mind of the adopters of the Idaho Constitution. And to exclude those concepts and those defenses, their defenses against government actions against the citizen. Certainly, we didn't have an administrative scheme for suspending somebody's driver's license at the time that Constitution was adopted. And I think that it simply is a failing to be able to exclude those from that proceeding. I think.
Aren't there lots of examples in the law, though, where some affirmative defenses aren't available? I'm thinking about like statutory rape, an honest mistake of age, even if it's an induced mistake of age, isn't a defense, and that's been challenged in court on constitutional grounds many times, and Idaho has still law.
I don't disagree with that, Judge, but as far as that applies here, I think that's a specific determination made off of a different issue.
Right, but my point is that it's not earth-shattering to have this court in the past conclude that some affirmative defenses aren't applicable in some cases, and the legislature makes that decision and is making it unconstitutional.
And certainly the court may make that decision today. But I think in this case, Judge, and other defenses have been identified, and I just think of situations. Your Honor pointed out a little disbelief about how impactful Reagan was on these administrative proceedings. And I think, honestly, it had a bigger impact than maybe you're aware of, Judge, because when Clark's decision came out, that was very changing in the context of DUI defense. That it had lots of implications when it came to domestic violence, but for a lot of us who are just ground-level criminal defense attorneys, that was a very big decision that led to a difference in the way that the police conduct their business. It led to...
I'm not incredulous that it had an impact in that way. I just... didn't think the decision should have been that surprising.
Well, that one, no, Judge, but what I'm leading to is the fact of Reagan was that extension to these administrative proceedings. That made a huge determination when the Clark decision came out. There were a lot of cases where hearing officers and the hearing officers were split. You had two of them at the time that were making administrative suspensions based off of Clark-related issues, and we had two that weren't. And the ones that were being sustained, there were a number of cases on appeal. I had one of those cases on appeal. It was very impactful to the law and the context of how those administrative proceedings go forward and how they affect our citizens. I think this is another one of those similar issues. I think in conjunction when we talk about other affirmative defenses, a little example of hyperbole here, maybe in an example of coercion where maybe a young lady is kidnapped literally at gunpoint from a bar and forced into a car and driven down the road where she crashes and the man escapes. That's a victim of a crime. But if an officer shows up and she's passed out behind the wheel and she's charged with DUI and she's given an administrative license suspension, the criminal proceeding can be proven. There may be evidence, there's investigation, you might have a confession, she can have that dismissed. But once that paper's filed with the department, that can't be raised as a defense. You have somebody who's one of our citizens who's wholly a victim of a crime through no fault of her own, who now has, and is subject to a license suspension, a fine, and an interlock requirement with no way to dispute it.
That example's not that abstract. We're dealing with that in trafficking cases.
I think that's something that should be remedied, Judge. That's why we're here.
But Reagan ties the, as Justice Mueller pointed out, Reagan ties the constitutional violation to the grounds, the statutory grounds for invalidating an ALS suspension, right?
It does, but the whole premise behind it being a statutory scheme in conjunction with the underlying criminal offense is the fact that there is an underlying criminal offense, again, without an ability to dispute that the conduct itself was actually not unlawful, which is what an affirmative defense does. I think that that's diminished.
Opposing counsel, though, makes a big deal of the distinction between gathering evidence and guilt or innocence with very separate considerations, right? Affirmative defenses typically don't apply to the gathering of evidence. In an affirmative defense, you're basically, not always, but most of the time, conceding that you did the illegal thing, but you had a greater reason for it, which would nullify intent. Reagan dealt with gathering evidence consistent with constitutional protections in the Fourth Amendment. I'm just trying to see the crossover that you're trying to have us find here.
Well, I mean, it's another mechanism of asserting your defense. I'm not trying to say that they're exactly the same. Certainly they're not. But, even in the jury instruction for necessity, if the elements of the offense, the elements of any affirmative defense, like self-defense, are satisfied factually, then the jury is instructed that they are not guilty of the offense. So it not only is it, it's not an after-the-fact excuse, it's a determination that the conduct itself originally was not unlawful.
The jury is not instructed to find them. The jury is instructed to make the findings, right?
Correct, but if the elements of an affirmative defense are met, then the jury is instructed to find the person not guilty. And so that's not an excuse of unlawful conduct, that is a determination that the conduct was not unlawful. And so that's where I think an affirmative defense really comes back to. This is something that is at the beginning of the case that can be determined, not just something that happens after the information gathering or the fact finding.
Was your client actually denied being able to allege in front of the hearing officer that he did have necessity? The hearing officer only ruled that doesn't move the needle for him.
The hearing officer let me make my presentation and in his findings, didn't go into any analysis of that, simply identified that he couldn't consider it.
I have to answer or ask one question.
Please.
This is, I appreciate your both arguments. It was a really interesting issue. And I'm sort of going back to common law itself. And my understanding, maybe from law school, but there's a lot of cases that say if it's not has a collision with the constitutions, both constitutions, and the legislature establishes a statutory law, and then that trumps, if you'll excuse the expression, that the statute trumps the common law. There's a lot of cases on that, which actually are common law because they're case law. So that's, I think that's one of the key points of this case, that you're arguing that, you know, and especially comparing Reagan, because that was based in constitutional protection. But the statutes, administrative statutes, don't provide that kind of protection, unless there's a decision, maybe in this case. But I want to just, you know, go back in the basics there, if you want to address that.
Well, that's exactly the situation that led to the appeal for Reagan, is the fact that he had a constitutional protection, he had the exclusionary rule through the poisonous tree, and that was in criminal context, that's an offense that can be asserted for the admissibility of the evidence. And ultimately that's how the court applied it, where the hearing officer couldn't consider that. But the exclusionary rule, other constitutional or Fourth Amendment protections that have been identified through the courts, they're not included in 18802 either. They're not one of the five things.
Sure, they're based on the Constitution. That, I mean, I think that's the difference. And I think you're trying to tie the necessity defense to the Constitution somehow, which is kind of the barrier here.
Yes.
Right? You have to get around the statutes.
I agree, Judge. But I think that's through the Sixth Amendment right to present a defense. I've asked the question before, is what is the nature of the administrative proceeding? Whether it's quasi-criminal, whether it's strictly civil, administrative. Necessity was a defense that can be used in civil cases as well. In torts, you have public necessity versus private necessity. That's well understood. That was well included in common law before the adoption of the Constitution or statute, main statutory aspects in Idaho Code. Those were well understood. Those have been neglected to be incorporated into administrative procedures.
So your hook on that to the Constitution, both constitutions, is that a defendant has the right, or in this case, not a defendant, but a petitioner, is the right to have a defense.
Yes, Judge.
That's the bottom line right there.
And the affirmative defenses are identified ways of asserting that defense. If there are elements and factual findings required to make a determination that the underlying conduct was not unlawful. And that's what we're seeking here, is just the same ability to do so for the hearing officer to simply be able to consider.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This matter is under advisement. We will render a decision accordingly and will now be in recess. Thank you.